You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. And this week I speak to Jason Hand of Microsoft, a coworker of mine and a really great person that I appreciate a lot of. You know, working in this business, you get some opportunities to meet really incredible people. And sometimes you get to work with them, and Jason's one of them. Jason's a great guy who I really feel is part of helping people make better decisions about technology, helping people learn more about what it is they can do in the cloud. And I'm really thankful that he gave me a few minutes while he was here in New York City. So one cool thing is I got some new intro music. I'm going to try this for a little bit because I'm into trap beats. What's up, everybody? And also, I was on vacation last week. Got to spend some time in Hawaii. And let me tell you, what a beautiful place. Really thankful that I got to do that trip. And sorry I didn't have a show for you last week, but it is what it is. Hawaii kind of took precedence, if you will. So let's get into the conversation with Jason. But before we get into that discussion, don't forget, we always want you to be part of this. So if you'd like to be on this podcast, the easiest way is just send me a notice. It's JDestro on Twitter. It's On Call Nightmare on Twitter. Or you could just email at very easily oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Let's get into the conversation with Jason now. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and just about every week, except for when I'm out of town and I'm on vacation, which was really cool, and I'll get into that at some other point in this podcast, I'm sure, probably in the intro that I do before this interview. But regardless, I'm going to bring you an interview with someone that is not only just a part of the team that I work on, but it's someone I really consider a friend, and that I'm really lucky is, been someone that we kind of just met on the road, and it kind of went from there. So his name is Jason Hand. He is part of the startups team, or what you call it, here in Microsoft's cloud advocacy team. What's up, Jason?
Hey, man. How's it going?
I think the coolest part is that we're getting to do this face-to-face, and we're doing it here at in my apartment because you were at QCon this week, right?
Yeah, I was just there yesterday giving a talk. So it's good to be here and hanging out with you before I got to go to the airport.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So one of the big kind of conversations that this podcast has been about is, on call and how people have made on call suck less. And for a long time, I really believed that that was one of your big jobs. You talk to people around the world for a while about how to make on-call suck less, and now you're really in a position where you're looking at the grand scheme of technology and maybe making IT implementation suck less, would you say?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it. And it's funny you say, making on-call suck less, because prior to joining Microsoft, I was with VictorOps, mm-hmm. and that was their tagline. That's the slogan that they use. Mm-hmm. We make on-call suck less, and it really speaks to a lot of people, because anybody who's been on call knows, regardless of what feelings you have towards that language in general, that being on call is not easy. It's cognitively draining. It's physically draining. It's just not something that's often pleasant. And so, big part of what I was doing while I was at VictorOps was trying to share ideas that make it just a little bit easier on you. So,
sure.
So we don't have this like fear of being on call, or this distaste of that whole responsibility, which more and more we're realizing it is important, because we're building things that people do rely on. And in mm-hmm. some cases, they rely on them for their health. They rely on them for their safety. They rely on them for their lives in general, their livelihood. And it's not just a matter of trying to keep our social media applications up and running. It's
sure.
actually trying to keep services and tech that is really important to people, trying to keep that up and running. So it's become a much more important topic, I think, as the world has become digitally connected.
And, well, reliability is kind of the big part of I guess, I don't want to call reliability a buzzword, because we've been talking about reliability as a, I guess, an industry for a very long time. But I feel like the focus has been taken off less of performance, and it's more on reliability. Reliability begat performance, I think.
Yeah.
And that's where I think this whole industry is going. But before we kind of get a little bit further into that, I want to find out where you came from. And that's one of my favorite parts about this podcast, is I get to bring it all the way back and ask you, so how did you get started on call?
Okay, well, if I sort of back all the way up to, gosh, right around just prior to year 2000. I remember the very first big concern I had was the 2000 bug.
Sure, Y2K.
Yeah, that was right out of college. I started working for a manufacturing company. Actually, it was a sort of the family business that I was working for. And I stepped into the role of just sort of a head of IT and had a small team. And was pretty much responsible for all of our internal servers. This was way before cloud. Mm-hmm. We had our own sort of internal mainframe ERP system. We had our own, eventually we had our own internal email server using Exchange, which later we moved to an open source solution. But it was really in that environment where I, you know, the buck stopped with me. Mm-hmm. And even though I had a team, I was the one who took on pretty much all responsibility for, sure. I would always joke, if it's plugged into a wall, then I'm probably responsible for it, because it went from our mainframe all the way to our fax machines and our phone system. And really, if electricity was running through it, people would come to me when it wasn't working.
So it's that early, early idea of on-call, where if there's someone in the house and they smell a little bit of smoke, you're the first fireman. They're going to, I'm guessing. They're not even going to look if there's fire. They're just going right to the fireman.
Yep, exactly. And most, you know, they knew that I was probably the most technical person within the company, but also someone who, you know, was just always willing to help, even if it didn't feel like it was part of my responsibility. I was able to come in and make things easier. So that's sort of my first, you know, not that I was always being paged and that kind of thing, but people would come to me when there was a problem.
You were the person early on that helped that business make sure that the technology that was put in place or needed to be put in place happened.
Yep.
And that's a kind of familiar, I think, role for a lot of people in that late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of practitioners. That's how we got our started, is that someone somewhere needed a person that was kind of capable of organizing all that stuff, because in the end there was a lot of organization before you even plugged anything into the wall.
Yep.
It was like, who are my vendors? Who am I going to make relationships with? Who's going to end up sending me the phone system? How much is the phone system support going to cost? So yeah, those are days that you learn so much about, I guess, internal IT before you even had to worry about web products.
Totally. I mean, that's where I think I developed what they call now the T-shape, is that I could try to specialize in certain things, but because I was responsible and involved with so much, I had to sort of spread out my time and my energy and becoming an expertise and all that stuff.
The early polyglots.
Yeah, exactly. And then from there, about fast forward maybe 10 years, I decided to make a change and I got into the startup world.
Sure.
And I took a role as the head of technical support for a company in Boulder, Colorado called Standing Cloud, which was a kind of a cloud broker where you could install applications on literally any cloud that you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a few clicks, you could transfer it to a different cloud. So you could start off on maybe AWS and realize, yeah, it's reliable service, it's quick, but it's also super expensive. So let me try, you know, Rackspace, let me try SoftLayer, let me try the Azure, whatever.
Sure.
So it made your applications and your infrastructure very portable. And that really was, I think, where I sunk my teeth into not only the cloud, but also the operations side of things, where you're starting to, you know, build up infrastructure using code in a lot of cases. And it's not a matter of me using a service like CDW and buying, you know, a bunch of servers that I then am going to have to, you know, rack them and get them all networked and all that stuff. I didn't have to do any of that. I would do that from a keyboard.
Sure.
And that's the world that we're kind of in now, or at least a lot of us are moving to, where it isn't these physical servers that we're dealing with.
Yes, and I think a lot of us in our lower backs are thankful for it. So
You move into this, and in this role, are you part of a formal rotation, or is this still kind of an ad hoc thing?
Well, it was a small team. There was only about 20 of us, and mm-hmm. so I was part of, even though I was head of support, a lot of times I would receive, of course, the first, you know, notice of a problem with, that a customer was having, mm-hmm. and then I would deal with work with our operations teams. Kind of in a coordinated effort to figure out what's going on and make some, you know, improvements or remediate whatever issues were going on. So I was a pager duty user, and I had to go through, you know, we had rotations, and we were then it seemed like a good idea to push out our big feature releases on Friday evenings, mm-hmm. Friday afternoons, which now we know is a horrible idea. That was another place where I really started to learn some of the nuance of being on call and having a coordinated response to it, and having a team of people that you know, maybe I'm the first responder and I'm the first person who kind of digs in, mm-hmm. but there's going to come a time where as I'm looking through whatever information I have, I realize this is beyond my level, or maybe I don't have access into a system where I need to go do some more like digging.
Yeah.
So I need to escalate, is what we would say, and I need to go find somebody who does have access to mm-hmm. that system and who does know a little bit more. And that's where I started seeing how, you know, you can really come up with a much more, I always just say, coordinated response,
yeah.
rather than being this reactionary kind of knee-jerk behavior whenever something goes wrong. It's more of a mind shift. It's mm-hmm. like you know something's going to go wrong eventually.
And it sounds like it's like a foreshadowing for where your career starts to move.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, I spent time at Standing Cloud, and when that company was acquired, shortly thereafter, I then moved over to VictorOps, mm-hmm. where the head of product was also an employee over at Standing Cloud, so mm-hmm. I kind of had that relationship. And she knew that, you know, I'd become very, I guess, familiar with the on-call sort of responsibility and how to make that better. And so when they were looking for someone to be their technology evangelist and sort of get out there and talk about really DevOps principles and some of the SRE stuff, she, you know, came to me, and I was super excited to come join VictorOps and do what I could to sort of improve everyone's scenario with on-call.
And like many of us who go into advocacy and evangelism, it's when you finally get off the on-call rotation and you start learning about how to explain to people what it's like to stop being on call.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other kind of experience in itself.
Yeah, and it's been... Yeah, I like to steal Nathan Harvey's phrase often, where he likes to say, we put down the pager and we picked up the microphone.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. Now, I'm not the practitioner who's on call anymore,
mm-hmm.
But I understand the pain of that, and sure. now I can sort of be more of a mentor role and a coach and say, let me help you by showing you or telling you and explaining to you the things that I've learned and that didn't go so well, so mm-hmm. that's not something you have to deal with.
Yeah, we people that kind of made that move, it feels like it's you're giving up some portion of either root, or you're giving up the pager or something, but you're picking up, I think, a very, very valuable new weapon of choice, if you will, in the microphone, because the microphone can really help you make people make better decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's what's really cool about where I guess both of us have wound up in our careers, since we both, you know, made the decision at some point to put down pagers. So let's move a little forward. And the podcast at this point normally likes to get into a little bit more about an incident. And I don't know if we're going to talk about a specific incident, but what I'd like you to talk to me is about, you know, your maybe a particular set of incidents that maybe helped formulate some better ideas for some places that in your travels.
Mm-hmm.
Before we do that, you know, it's always important for me to mention that this podcast has rules. And as the enforcer of these rules, I'm going to share them with you. First, don't incriminate yourself, and then I think you're going to be all right on here. You're going to go with some generalities, and you're not going to incriminate others, because the big part of this podcast is that we always remember in DevOps we are blameless in our retrospectives. And the third rule is help us learn, because this podcast is a retrospective. So why don't you give me not necessarily an interesting incident from a nightmare, but can you give me kind of maybe a little bit of background on some of the big issues you saw that were creating nightmares in organizations that didn't have good on-call policies?
Yeah. So the thing I see consistently is that a lot of times, well, first of all, a lot of companies haven't put enough thought or any thought in many cases into what are we going to do when something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They have more of a focus on let's do what we can to prevent things from going wrong, which if you've been doing this long enough, it seems like that we're on some sort of treadmill. We can never get to this like ideal situation of preventing problems to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've studied anything about complex systems and systems thinking, you know that that's just an impossibility. It isn't something that can be done. You can't control complex systems and prevent things from happening. So once you've sort of had that mind shift that prevention isn't really possible, it's not a reality, then you move away from that idea and more into, well, if something's going to go wrong, how do we know something's going to go wrong? Then what are we going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part, which is I think what I focus on a lot too, is how do we learn from that?
Sure.
How do we improve from that? Because if this is just going to be a routine thing, if this is going to be a natural part of the work, although it seems unplanned, what can we do to make this feel like it is more part of our work and that it should be planned and that we should be thinking about when something goes wrong, first of all, what monitoring and observability tools are telling us that something's mm-hmm. not quite right. And this gets into a whole conversation about setting service level indicators and objectives and error budgets and the whole SRE conversation.
Yeah.
Then there's also the part about, okay, monitoring has alerted us that something's going not quite right or we're getting dangerously close to an imminent failure. What are we going to do about it? Who's going to be the first people that need to be made aware of these issues?
Mm-hmm.
What information and context do they need to actually do something about it? What access into systems do they need?
Mm-hmm.
Who is the right person? You know, we talk a lot about putting devs on call, and there's definitely a lot of people out there who push back on that because they don't feel they have the experience or the access into the systems to actually do anything to you know help with that. And that's again a whole other conversation about how we should be putting our developers on call. And then once you've really started to figure out what is the right response, and I like to remind people that we are after a response, not we don't want to react to problems. Like reactionary kind of has this insinuation that we weren't aware something was going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and we've already covered, we have to be aware that something's going to happen. So how do we improve just that response to take what might normally be a 3-hour outage and make it a 15-minute routine, you know, response? Like, this, we've seen this before, we know exactly what to do in this situation, and we can mitigate it very quickly.
So do you think that the big problem with companies that maybe you've talked to in the past has been walking into their room and seeing zero plan of action?
Yeah.
Like, that's the way I kind of feel. When I worked in consulting, and a company would come to me and they would say, what do we do when our site goes down? You know, I asked, what are you already doing?
Mm-hmm.
And when they already don't have an answer for that, and they just say, oh, I don't know, we call Ted. Or we call, you know, somebody, and Ted goes in, logs in, and 15 minutes later, I get a phone call that says, hey, give me 15 more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way I remember a lot of these things went.
Yeah.
And you have to start saying, well, look, Ted ain't going to be there all the time.
Right.
And Ted's extra 15 minutes is a question. You know, why did Ted need that extra 15 minutes? Why wasn't it part of the actual, like, answer? And so I feel like I really appreciate one of the things that you've done, which is help businesses say, you need a map. You need a map. You need a way to actually enact this so that these, like you say, the 3-hour turns to 15 minutes. So how did you start really providing people with a map? Like, how does that process begin?
Mm-hmm. I think a big part of it is that you need to have a conversation with, you know, as an engineering org or you know, a development team, you have to have a conversation of what is appropriate for us. You
mm-hmm.
know, I always avoid very prescriptive, like, approaches of like, do this. I don't believe in terms like best practices. I think it's a unique situation across everyone's own scenario. But I think having that, starting that conversation of saying, first of all, what monitoring do we have in place? How do we even know when something's wrong? Because if it's our customers that are telling us through customer support that our site's down or that, you know, credit card processing isn't working or they can't log in, if the customer knew that before you did, that's your first problem.
Sure.
We've got some observability issues. We've got some blind spots in our monitoring. So let's start there. And if you're familiar with SRE and like Google's approach to SRE, especially the Site Reliability Engineering book that O'Reilly published, they talk about the hierarchy of reliability. Mm-hmm. And it always starts with monitoring. Monitoring is how you know something's not right. And then, that's where I start the conversation, is what are you doing with monitoring? And then from there is, well, once you know something's wrong, monitoring's time to tell you, like, you're out of bounds, you know, you're dangerously close. What methods do you have to inform the right people? So it's the alerting process. Mm-hmm. Are you using old school pagers with, you know, or just SMS, or are you using email, which, by the way, terrible idea to alert people on email.
And if you're going to a third party provider, like your pager duties, your VictorOps, et cetera, like, what are their SLAs to make sure that you're getting everything? So how far deep down the stack have you gone, if you will? How far can you trace it to make sure that you've met all these, you know, answers so that you can say, all right, at least we know how to get what's failing.
Yeah.
What do you do after? Yeah. So how do you tell them, okay, what we've got in place for you is an idea of how to better at least get information. I think that one of the hardest parts, and you can tell me that this, is actually identifying signal through noise. And how do you actually change the culture of monitoring? Mm-hmm. Because you said it yourself, observability is important. But the culture of monitoring, in my previous experience, was we're going to monitor all these particular services on X server. And it's going to tell us how much of these percentages of utilization is going on. And then we're going to set some arbitrary values that we believe, based on a template, is our go-to thing. Like, how do you tell people, like, your go-to thing doesn't work? Like, how do you get that, like, let's move you to something more prescriptive rather than reactive?
Yeah. Well, the thing I like to remind people is, like, we all work for a business, and the businesses exist to provide some sort of value to the end user. You know, somebody's paying for a service or they're using a service, and that service is providing value to them. It accomplishes a task. Maybe it's something like just, you know, logging into your bank and moving money around. Maybe it's something that's, you know, related to healthcare, like trying to get some records over to your doctor. But there's value in the technology that we're building. The value is provided by the services that, you know, are built, and services are provided by applications, and applications are provided by the infrastructure. That's sort of the relationship. Those are the lines.
So try to create a value to ensuring that infrastructure isn't just monitored, but is properly monitored.
Right. And I think it's a matter of kind of shifting your perspective away from traditional monitoring. We would look for things at the infrastructure level and also maybe the application level.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually, that is, especially in a cloud world, not that interesting. It's not that important because
it's user experience.
Well, it doesn't give us any indication of what's going on with the users. In fact, you could have all of your infrastructure and everything sort of looking, maybe from a dashboard perspective, looking red.
Mm-hmm.
Everything looks terrible. The whole world's on fire. Yet your users are still able to do what they're trying to do. So this is where you start talking about the noise. Is like, if you're just monitoring for the technical components and the things that may fail there, you're gonna get a lot of noise, especially in a cloud situation. And that's not always actionable, because a lot of times you might see a spike in CPU usage, or you might see a memory, you know, problem. But a lot of times those things will just clear themselves up, because it's actually not that. It's something else that's having an issue that's sort of downstream causing other problems.
So application access is fine. You're just having IO increase, maybe because of a background process that's got nothing to do with serving the application.
Absolutely. So this is where SRE has become, I think, so useful for a lot of businesses, is because it shifts our perspective on monitoring away from the technical components, which do not give us any kind of insight into how the value of the business is, you know, sort of being, I guess, provided.
Sure.
What it's doing is it's just telling us that there's these little technical components that are, you know, kind of breaking and fixing and breaking and fixing, or just being noisy in general. So the SRE kind of mindset shifts our perspective more towards the value that we're trying to provide. And that means that we have to find a different way of monitoring. And so monitoring itself has really evolved into, if you're following sort of the SRE conversations, we set what we call as service level indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few different types of things that we feel are good indicators of the value that we're trying to provide. And it leads us into conversations of like latency and, you know, just congestion on the network or saturation. And there's all these sort of different things that every, I think, business has to decide what is an indication, what is a leading indication of the value we're trying to provide, and let's monitor for that. And so they set service level indicators that tell us, or they create service level indicators that tell us over the course of time, where is the sort of value existing at any point in time.
Yeah.
And then we set the objectives, which is our sort of line in the sand. And we say, okay, so if this is our service level indicators, it's giving us an indication of the value we're providing or not providing. What is the objective? What is the line that we say, if this is crossed, now it's time to take action?
Yeah, if it takes me 15 seconds to transfer $25 from A point to B point, then something's wrong. If it takes 5 seconds, that's fine. That's even if that means that there's a CPU process that's overutilized, and maybe that 5 seconds is within the bounds of when you're okay, when it really should only be one or two.
Mm-hmm.
I get where you're coming from.
Exactly.
That you need to find out what's an acceptable weight for what humans do. And I think that that really comes down to, and this is kind of outside the scope of the podcast, but it's a great thing to bring up, is this is what product experience is all about, I think, in the long term, is that as someone who does, like, you know, product experience testing, they're going in with users or you know, Selenium tests or whatever, and determining what is an acceptable amount of time for a process to occur.
Yep.
And without people that actually specialize in determining how long that's going to take, what's acceptable, what can we do to improve that, then I think that we don't get to what those service level, like, objectives are.
Right.
And so I think that there's a huge part in the product process that can really help people at the SRE level even have better experiences.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's why I believe that, and here's where the DevOps part of all of it kind of puts a nice, cute little hat on top, if you will. This is the DevOps part, is that we're opening up communication between teams when we ensure that SRE and product are talking about the long-term viability and how objective levels are set, what's a failure that's okay on the customer level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I don't think SRE really works if you don't have product heavily involved with it. And that was a model that we set up at VictorOps, is we created what we called the SRE Council, because we didn't want an SRE team. We didn't want to create another silo.
Sure.
And we didn't want SREs, as site reliable engineers, because then all the responsibility of reliability kind of just naturally seems to fall on those folks.
Sure.
And reliability is the responsibility of everyone.
Sure.
All the way up to the leadership, because we have to think of it as we provide, it's more value reliability engineering. And I like to say we're protecting the value of the business. It's the reliability of the value that we were after. It's not the reliability of the servers. It's not the reliability of the apps. Those are means to provide a thing that our users want. So we have to shift all of our monitoring in that direction. And then we can reduce this whole problem with noise and you know, pager fatigue and all the alert fatigue and those types of things by monitoring and alerting only on things when our objectives have been breached.
Sure.
Or when our error budget has been exhausted.
Have you ever had a person really sit down with you to help them find what exactly, like, are the right things to breach on? Like, have you spent time, and maybe this is a great way to talk about how a nightmare got resolved.
Yeah.
Like, did you ever have to spend that time finding what was out of bounds and what was no longer acceptable because that business didn't even understand it yet?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, a big part of SRE and what we have sort of concluded or have determined at Microsoft is that SRE isn't, like I was just mentioning, it's not a, it doesn't have to be a thing that is solely responsible or the responsibility of a group or a person.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we all think about. And so what I liked to do, or what I like to do and what I did at VictorOps is really go throughout everyone, all the stakeholders, anybody mm-hmm. who has a strong stake in the value and the thing that we're trying to build, including the product team, including the CEO, and say, what worries you about your business, about your company? What is it that really scares you and keeps you up at night? And let's discuss all that. Let's get those out on, you know, on a whiteboard or whatever. And then let's talk about how can we monitor for that. It may seem like it's an abstract thing,
mm-hmm.
but we can find ways to tie those concerns back to quantitative
sure.
numbers.
How do abstract issues become resolvable problems?
How are we alerted that on any given day at 3 p.m., we usually have, and I say usually, have maybe 10,000 people in our system. That's what we would call normal. If suddenly we went from 10,000 users down to 50 users, wouldn't you want to know about that? Doesn't
sure.
that seem like it's a leading indicator of a problem with your system? Even though all your servers and your apps and everything seems fine,
mm-hmm.
something isn't quite right, and it's affecting your business.
Yeah, it could be something as simple as a database is down and your user database is not properly, you know, allowing people to authenticate, or a portion of it is broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? It could be any different number of, or maybe your OAuth, where people are getting a specific API for a certain type of OAuth, they're down.
Yeah.
And that's why a portion of you. So I guess what I like to think about with modern monitoring, and me saying that with my awful New York accent, modern monitoring. I like to think about it in this really big scheme of things, is that you should be thinking about what the person with the phone or the mouse is going to be accomplishing. And when you think about the big picture of what you're looking for out of a monitoring
mm-hmm.
solution, it should be, how am I going to make sure that the person on the other side of the phone or the mouse gets the fastest response from this application that I'm providing reliability for? And
mm-hmm.
and that's the big difference. And so just looking for memory utilization, just using, you know, CPU, it's not enough anymore.
Totally. And to come back to, like, your original question of how do you make all this better? How do you make the on-call experience better?
Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of starts with that. It's like you really have to rethink what monitoring is and should be for whatever it is that you're trying to provide your users,
mm-hmm.
and maybe pivot on what we actually monitor. Maybe putting agents in all of the boxes isn't telling us anything other than those agents aren't behaving like they should be, but that doesn't really tell us anything about what our users are experiencing.
Yeah, I think we focus too much on the tool and not actually what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we think, well, maybe if we use Sensu instead of Prometheus to get us this information. You know what I mean? Like, there's all these ideas. Let's try another tool, maybe that other tool. Well, maybe the problem isn't the tool. Maybe your Nagios is fine. Maybe it's just you're not necessarily setting thresholds properly, and that's why your Nagios is causing you an issue.
Mm-hmm.
That moving to another platform or another tool isn't going to fix it. It's taking a holistic view,
yeah.
if you will, and I think that's where we're at.
Absolutely. I almost can't get through an interview without using the word holistic, because we get so focused and we have our specializations, and we know what we know and what we're good at, and
mm-hmm.
we've just put all of our energy into that,
mm-hmm.
and so we have these, we all work with blinders on. And I think it's becoming more and more important that we take those blinders off, that we move back to a 10,000 foot or higher view and see what is, I always just come back to the term value. What is the thing? Why do we show up and write code? Why do we show up and create infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we doing these things? It's not necessarily just to create apps. You know, these
so
apps,
people use them.
It's,
yeah.
it's to solve problems for people.
Sure, sure.
And so what is the problem that they're trying to solve?
Mm-hmm.
And are we delivering on that? That's what monitoring is trying, or should be trying, to solve for in a sort of more current scenario.
Makes a lot of sense. So let's start wrapping it up toward the end. We've been chit-chatting for a while, and I want to make sure that I make the most and best use of this time. Mm-hmm. So if someone is listening to you and I talk about things today, and they're on call, what's a piece of advice you'd give that person?
I think the main thing is to really think about being on call as just a natural part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that should be dumped onto the laps of specific people. I think it's something everybody has to take ownership in. And if we sort of take that mentality that this is something everybody is responsible for, there are better ways to monitor that's not so noisy and those types of things, it really sort of lessens that anxiety about being on call, and it makes it just normal work. It's not so unplanned. It's not so reactionary. We in fact, the talk I gave at QCon yesterday, I tried to communicate that incidents are really just a feedback mechanism of what's going on with your system.
Sure.
They're not bad. Incidents are going to happen. There's mm-hmm. going to be problems. There's going to be blips. There's going to be maybe even outages.
Having a reason for them and knowing how to prevent them. That's the big thing.
Yeah, yeah. And they're not. They shouldn't be seen as noise. You may have a noisy system, but that just means maybe you got to reassess what you're monitoring.
Incidents are learning experiences. They're a learning experience.
They're a natural part of a complex system. Sure. So instead of trying to reduce, you want to mitigate, them, and you want to take things that are repeating problems and try to reduce that or get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
But to have this idea that we can do away with them or prevent them is just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really comes down to making those incidents and those problems be reassigned as just a normal part of our system. And then that means we can switch from reactionary to response. And then also the most important thing, which we really haven't had a chance to talk too much about, is when the fire is put out, you don't just roll up the hoses and go back to work.
No, you chat about it.
You got to have a deep discussion. And it's not just about what broke. I am one of the people out there who will tell you root causes is crap. Root cause analysis does not do anything for you.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're following that very prescriptive approach of asking sort of the five whys type of mentality. I think it's better than doing nothing. But you're leaving so much information just unexplored about what really is going on with your systems, and I should say what's really going on within your socio-technical systems, because it's none of this happens without people.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have to understand, when Jay was paged in the middle of the night and it took him 10 minutes to respond, I would like to discuss more about that. It's not a problem, like you mentioned earlier. This is blameless.
Mm-hmm.
But you were the primary, the first responder. 10 minutes to respond seems a little lengthy.
Yeah, what went into the 10 minutes?
Exactly, and it turns out you've been on call for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And also during that 2 weeks, there's been a lot of noise. And,
sure.
And a lot of times you would log in to your system and find out the thing has already resolved itself.
Or so, maybe the 10 minutes is because I was at the bar, and you know what? I didn't take this alert seriously because I've been on call for 2 weeks, and every other alert like it hasn't been something to take too seriously.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things that, to be honest with you, if you're on call, recognize when you're being overpaged and start to talk about it with people. And I think that's really, to sum up what you kind of said, if you're noticing people are failing and time is showing you it,
mm-hmm.
look into why it's happening, and it may be because of your own management practices and not giving people enough rope to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to go hang out this weekend,
mm-hmm.
and maybe I'm not going to be on call because I had a double, really bad incident last week.
Totally. And then on the other side of that, too, there's so much that can be learned from something that we don't even identify as an incident.
Mm-hmm.
There's things out there that could have gone really bad, but someone did something to prevent that from going bad or from getting much worse.
Sure.
And so you might call that a near miss, but because we didn't label it as an incident and it wasn't something that was actually an outage of beyond a certain severity level.
So just hitting the inner bounds of failure, if you will, or just the near bounds of failure before something really bad happens.
Yeah, but if you stop and think about it, isn't it important to understand what did Jay Gordon do to prevent that from going really south? And why wouldn't we do a retro on that? Why wouldn't we have a discussion about
that? And why would it even have gotten to that point? Like, why didn't we have scaling systems in place to be able to prevent that or whatever it is? So,
And then on top of that, once you realized, you jumped in and you started diagnosing what's going on, no two people are going to do the same thing with the same, problem. So, like, maybe you would have one approach, but I would have a different approach. And so we've got some dissent in our, actions. And I think that that's another thing, too. There's not always a right and wrong way to solve problems, but there's a lot of information that should be disseminated across your entire team about the next time we see something like this happen, something similar, it's got all the same symptoms, what do we as a team feel like is the appropriate response? Here's what I would recommend. Let's go and take a look at our logs first. Maybe we want to hop into Prometheus. Or into Azure Monitor, maybe Log Analytics. Like it doesn't really matter what the tech is, but let's figure out what is the appropriate response for something like this. And you've been doing it longer than me in maybe that situation, and so I can learn something from you.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's what comes out of a good retro, and it doesn't often come out of an RCA.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So we're gonna wrap it up, and before we wrap it up, I wanna just let Jason get a minute to let people know about kind of what he's been up to lately, because he's been a busy dude. One of the coolest things that I know you've been doing is riding around in a van.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that van, man.
Yeah, it's my... I bought a ProMaster camper van late last year. My plan was to kind of use it as a mobile office. I'm traveling all the time anyway, but when I'm home, it's kind of nice to sit still a little bit. But I also like to get out and enjoy the Colorado lifestyle.
Sure.
And so, I went on this what I called the DevOps road trip recently, where I had three different events, all in the Western U.S. It was the first domestic events I've had all year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and I spoke at DevOps Days Boise. Then I went up to Monitorama in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And then I drove down sort of the Oregon and California coast along the Pacific Coast Highway and ended up in San Francisco for a startup event that Microsoft was putting on, where I spoke about incident management, and then made my way back to Denver. So I did this kind of loop of a little over 4,000 miles.
But he flew here, everybody. Don't worry.
He flew here
to New York.
One of these days I'll drive the van out to the East Coast, but... it was a super, super fun thing. It was really neat to be able to still get to all of my conferences that I need to, but reduce my carbon footprint. This is something we've talked about as advocates. We get shipped around all over the place, and it kind of wears on some of us. For me anyway, I get a little bit conscientious of what I'm doing to the planet by going all over the place. And so
I got you.
I was able to, really kind of do something positive about that. Rather than flying to Boise and home and then to Portland and home and San Francisco and home, I'm just going to drive, and see more of the country that I hadn't seen before. So, and then along the way, try to share what I'm doing and what's going on with people at the different events and the things that I'm learning. And just try to, amplify more of this DevOps mentality and modern both monitoring and incident management, which turned out to be a fun little experiment. And it was pretty neat.
Awesome, man. Well, you know what? Thank you very much for doing this today. I really appreciate it. And people can find you on Twitter at Jason Hand, right?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
And so we'll be right back with the wrap up this week's episode of the On-Call Nightmares podcast. Thank you very much, dude. Because we're here in person, I'm going to thank you with a good old-fashioned loud handshake.
All right.
There we go.
Perfect.
All right. We'll be right back. Well, that's it for this week of On-Call Nightmares. If you'd like to be part of the podcast, please reach out. It's really easy. You can email me at oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or you can also reach out very easily on Twitter. It's @oncallnightmare, or if you'd like to, you can reach out to me personally at @jdestro. So thanks again for listening. It's been another great episode. I appreciate your time, and we'll see you next time as I continue to talk to people who have spent time on call in technology. Thanks.